VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Rick Pantaleo, our in-house science and technology expert and host of VOA's daily Science in a Minute. Our special guest on this edition of the program is David Sanger, veteran New York Times national security correspondent and author of the timely new book, The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. In The Perfect Weapon, David Sanger traces the escalation of cyber warfare and explores how wars can now be won or lost without a shot being fired. It reveals the startling inside story of how the rise of cyber weapons in all their forms, from attacks on electric grids to attacks on electoral systems, has transformed geopolitics like nothing since the invention of the airplane and the atomic bomb. In his book, Sanger focuses largely on the so-called seven sisters of cyber conflict: the United States, Russia, China, Britain, Iran, Israel, and North Korea. He illustrates how cyber conflict has expanded since the revelation of the U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran's nuclear program called Operation Olympic Games, which started under President George W. Bush and expanded under President Barack Obama. Sanger exposed the story of Washington's role in those attacks 6 years ago in his book, Confront and Conceal. In his new book, The Perfect Weapon, he explores how great and small powers alike have moved into the new era of constant sabotage, misinformation, and fear, in which everyone is a target. A decade ago, there were three or four nations with effective cyber forces. Now there are more than 30. Yet, as a global cyber conflict took off, America turned out to be unprepared. In an ominous statement at a recent congressional hearing, the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, said Russian cyber attacks on U.S. democracy are continuing, and we are doing little to counter them. Drawing an explicit comparison with the situation before the 9/11 attacks, Coats declared, quote, "The warning lights are blinking red again." New York Times correspondent David Sanger has written two additional books, Confront and Conceal and The Inheritance, about which we interviewed him several years ago, which covers the national security challenges since the beginning of former President Barack Obama's administration. And we are delighted to welcome him back to the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss his new book, The Perfect Weapon. David Sanger, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Carol. Great to be back at VOA.
And as always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you.
Well, David, congratulations on your book. It's a terrific and timely one. What, in your view, makes a cyber weapon the perfect weapon?
It's a great question, Carol. And the reason the book is titled The Perfect Weapon is that cyber is unlike almost all of the weapons that we've seen before, certainly in the 20th century. It's dirt cheap. It's fairly easy to target, and it's fairly easy to build. You don't need the kind of materials from plutonium to uranium or millions of dollars or billions of dollars in infrastructure you need for nuclear weapons. It's deniable. You can dial it up and you can dial it down. And perhaps most importantly, it's available to countries that realize they could not take on the United States or a similar large military power in a direct conflict. And so it's become the primary way that countries undercut and compete with each other, particularly when there's an imbalance of power. And that's what we've seen as the most wired society on Earth, the United States, deals with far less wired but increasingly capable cyber adversaries.
I'd like to talk about a story that you broke, the story about the Operation Olympic Games, in which the United States under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama used malicious code to blow up Iran's nuclear centrifuges. What was the fallout from that? And are there lessons in that successful attack that we implemented that we can glean for today's threats, especially from Russians who have attacked our electrical grid and our electoral process?
Well, it's a really fascinating issue because when President Obama was first briefed on Olympic Games by President Bush, it was being handed off from one to the other, he hadn't really thought very much about the use of offensive cyber. It was brand new to military planners, brand new to a lot of intelligence agencies. And certainly it hadn't been used on that sophisticated a scale. But as he delved into it, he began to worry about something that he asked some of his aides kids about. He said, you know, one day it's going to become clear that the United States and Israel were behind these attacks. And when it does, every other country in the world that wants to make a mark against the United States is going to use the fact that the Americans were the first to use a truly sophisticated cyber weapon as an excuse to justify their own use of cyber. And that's exactly what happened. After Olympic Games, the Iranians attacked Saudi Aramco, the biggest oil producer. The North Koreans attacked South Korea and later went after Sony here in the United States. You've seen cases of Russia attacking not only the State Department and the White House and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but obviously going after much of Ukraine. So what's happened is in a short 6 or 7 years, this has become an accepted form of international conflict, and one that's used pretty much every day.
I'd like to turn to my colleague, Rick.
Well, we've been talking about the actions of former Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. How far back does cybersecurity issues becoming a national security issue? I mean, when did this start? When did we start realizing that cyber can be weaponized?
Well, I think within the intelligence community, it's been recognized for some time, and certainly back to the presidency of the man America just buried, George H.W. Bush. But as a real forefront issue in American defense, really in the past decade, if you go back, as I did for this book, to the national threat assessments that the intelligence community has to give, it's an unclassified document given to Congress each year, and you go to the 2007 National Intelligence Threat Assessment, and you look for the cyber section, you won't find one. The word is not in the document. It's just 11 years ago. Terrorism, of course, was the top of the list. For the past 5 years, Rick, cyber has been the number one threat, ahead of terrorism, ahead of nuclear weapons, ahead of Iran and North Korea and everything else America obsesses about, even ahead of the rise of China and Russia's disruptive activities. So this has come on pretty fast, and the result is that the United States didn't have the kind of playbook for it that it had in the Cold War for nuclear weapons, or even that it developed after 9/11 for counterterrorism, where we sort of understood how we would absorb a terror attack, how we would respond, what we would do to deter them, what we would do nationally to try to detect them ahead of time. All of that has been missing in cyber until the past few years. And I think you have to give some credit to President Obama and some to the first year of President Trump for building that up. Unfortunately, the Trump administration managed in the course of its great turnovers to purge many of the people who had been working on this issue at the White House level.
Follow-up question to that is, have there been any of particular events that are well known that may have brought cyber warfare to the attention of national security officials?
Well, they really start back in the Russian attacks on Estonia and Georgia in 2007, 2008, 2009. But for the United States, I think one of the biggest revelations came really in 2008 as they discovered a very successful Russian effort to get inside the CIPRNet, the internal communications programs that are used largely by the military, but also tie together other parts of the U.S. government. That was a real wake-up call that began to bring about the rise of United States Cyber Command, which has recently been elevated again by President Trump and is now a full command, just as there's Central Command that handles the Middle East and Northern Command that defends the United States and Pacific Command that deals with Asia. Cyber Command is supposed to be the central U.S. military force for defense and offense. And of course, the National Security Agency has long been doing that on the covert side for the intelligence world.
And yet there are so many shortcomings, which we'll get into in a minute. But I want to go back to Russia's actions in Ukraine, David, which you chronicle in the book. And you call Russia's actions in Ukraine as a sort of a laboratory and a test run for their nefarious activities in the United States. Discuss the connection between what the Russians have been doing in Ukraine since 2014, their illegal annexation of Crimea, their attack on Ukraine's electrical grid, and what they've been doing in the United States, particularly in the run-up and throughout the 2016 election campaign.
Well, Carol, you go to Ukraine and you quickly discover that every single thing that the Russians did against the United States, and several that they haven't done yet, were practiced first in a Ukrainian environment. In fact, the chapter on Ukraine in the book is called Putin's Petri Dish, which is exactly how you have to sort of view the country. They turned off the electric power twice in different parts of Ukraine, remotely, to the point that when you went out and interviewed the people who were working in the utilities, they were sitting in their control rooms, basically helpless as they saw the cursor move around their screens being controlled by an unseen force. They mucked in the election that ended up electing President Poroshenko, who was defeating a pro-Russian candidate. And in that case, they even got into the reporting system for the electoral votes for the election and reported a different outcome in Russia than actually got reported in Ukraine because the Ukrainians caught on to it at the last moment. You've seen cases of data manipulation happening throughout. So everything that we worry about happened there. The United States sent some teams down to take a look at what had happened in the electrical grid when that power went off. But interestingly, much less focus on the election system because there just wasn't a sense that the Russians were prepared to leap the Atlantic and come try something bold in an American election.
And yet they did.
They did indeed.
And I wanted to ask you about an interesting term you used, the Gerasimov Doctrine. Please define what you mean by that and why it perfectly encapsulates the nexus between information warfare and cyber warfare that we are experiencing, that we experienced in the run-up to the 2016 elections.
Well, Gerasimov, of course, is the chief of staff of the Russian military and holds that post to this day. And his doctrine had basically called for forms of warfare that would run the gamut from physical to cyber to information warfare. That Russian way of looking at this problem is different from the American way. Americans tend to think of cyber actions as going into a network either to steal information or to make something physical happen in the physical world, as the U.S. and Israel did in the attacks on the Iranian centrifuges, where code they put in sped up and slowed down those centrifuges until they blew up. But information warfare, basically propaganda put on steroids because of the speed and spread of the internet, was always considered something separate by Americans. It's considered something on the same spectrum by the Russians. And of course, in 2016, as you point out, that's exactly what happened. The shame on us is we weren't ready for it. Even though the Russians had been seen inside the State Department and the White House and so many other government computer systems, it was assumed they were just spying. And spying, in the view of the Obama administration and many administrations before it, is just part of the game. We do it to them, they do it to us. What no one really thought about was that the data that they stole might actually be made public in an effort to try to influence the outcome of an election. And of course, that was the central shock of 2016.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is David Sanger. He's the author of The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. He's also national security correspondent for the New York Times. I'm Carol Castiel, along with my colleague Rick Pantaleo, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on our website and on iTunes. You can find the download at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, and connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout-out to a valued listener, Namatula Asadi from Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And I think my colleague's chomping at the bit for a question. Rick, go ahead.
Regarding cyber warfare, what is the difference between sporadic hacking attacks and actual cyber warfare?
Well, you know, we haven't really seen, Rick, the outbreak of full-scale cyber warfare at this point. If you're trying to think in history where we are in cyber, I guess the closest I could get us to it is we're kind of where we were in air power at the end of World War I. Orville and Wilbur Wright had turned their invention over to the U.S. military. The military had built thousands of aircraft. There had been a few skirmishes in World War I with the Germans, but nothing decisive. It wasn't really until World War II, some 25, 30 years later, that you began to see air power play a decisive role. In cyber, we've also seen a few skirmishes. We've seen the Russians turn off a little power here and there. We've seen mucking in elections. We've seen the U.S. use it against Iranian and North Korean nuclear programs. But we haven't seen a full-scale war. What we do know is that in the war plans of all of the major powers, and probably some of the minor ones, cyber is worked in, integrated into it in the early planning. So in the book, I describe a plan that the United States had if it did, in fact, have to go to war with Iran prior to the 2015 nuclear agreement that the Obama administration struck with the Iranian leadership. And that was a plan called Nitro Zeus, which basically would have gone in and unplugged Tehran in the opening hours of a war. The theory being that if you conduct a war with cyber first, you might not need to ever drop a bomb.
You're talking about we haven't really seen cyber warfare yet, but I'm curious, can you describe what an all-out, worst-case scenario cyber war would be like?
You know, most of the book is about the sort of day-to-day short of war operations that we're seeing each day, because countries are too smart to get into a direct military conflict, but they still want to show their influence. Once you went to a full-scale war, then everything would change because you're no longer calibrating your cyber attacks to avoid a military response. You're actually using them to deter one. So that's when you would see the attacks on the electrical grid, on the communication systems, on everything that sort of binds a country together in hopes of paralyzing it, causing chaos, and interfering with the communication systems. So let me give you an interesting example. Right now, our nuclear forces are pretty disconnected from the internet or most cyber interference. And partly that's because we've deliberately kept them walled off, but partly it's because they're so old and they were reliant on systems in a pre-cyber age. One of the dangers as we go and modernize those systems, both for safety and for better communications, is that you could actually introduce cyber vulnerabilities to it. And people are highly aware of that. In the book, I describe how the United States did go after North Korea's missile launches in an effort to try to slow them down, just as they slowed down the Iranian nuclear program. It's an interesting question. Would we risk doing that with Russian or Chinese missile forces? I doubt it, because of our concern about their ability to do the same to ours. And this really gets to the question of whether there should be some things, voting systems, electric grids, nuclear systems that are off limits for cyber under a kind of cyber digital Geneva Convention, if we ever got together on one.
So, David, that leads us to ask, why is the overall level of U.S. cybersecurity, both in the private and public domain, so weak? You know, we've witnessed so many attacks, whether it was the Chinese attack on our Office of Personnel Management in 2015, which compromised large amounts of personal data on 22 million Americans, whether it's the Russians' attack on our democracy in 2016, and prior to that, the North Koreans' attack on Sony Pictures, so much. So why are we not prepared?
You know, it's a variety of reasons. It's a really great question. You know, Sony and the Office of Personnel Management, which holds the records of everybody who's got a security clearance in the United States, something you'd think would be pretty important, were basically wide open. The Chinese were clearing out those records, and they were actually, the records were unencrypted, astoundingly enough, and then the Chinese encrypted them on the way out so that we wouldn't see what it was they were stealing. And most of these were housed in the Department of the Interior's computer systems, just a few blocks from where we are today. And nobody noticed. So we are astoundingly vulnerable. That isn't to say that our cybersecurity hasn't improved. It's improved dramatically. Think how many people use two-factor authentication now when dealing with their bank, you know, where that six-digit code is sent back from the bank to make sure it's you to your cell phone. Now, there are ways around that, of course. But the fact of the matter is, we've improved in our cybersecurity, but the problem, that attack surface I described on the Internet of Things, has expanded exponentially while our improvement in cybersecurity has been gradual. So we're falling further behind even while we are improving.
And what are the dangers of combating cyber warfare? For example, if we fight back in kind or try to preempt an attack,
like destroying malicious code before it's actually executed, could that unleash an era of cyber warfare, as was alluded to earlier?
Sure. I mean, there are escalation issues here, just as there are escalation issues in any other form of warfare, including nuclear warfare. And in the nuclear world, academics began to coin a phrase called escalation dominance. It meant before you went into an escalating war, you wanted to make sure that you had played it out several chess moves ahead and you would remain dominant so somebody wouldn't escalate against you. But the fact of the matter is that doesn't exist in cyber. It doesn't exist because weaker powers are, in an odd way, unless wired powers, more able to attack us than we are to attack them. Imagine a cyber attack on the United States by North Korea. There are probably more IP addresses, internet protocol addresses, in this headquarters building of Voice of America than there are in all of North Korea. So to say that if the North Koreans are going to attack our networks, our stock market, or whatever networks you have in mind, and that we would counterattack on their cyber capability, that's a ridiculous proposal from the beginning. So you have to begin to pick things that are not in the cyber realm for the kind of escalation dominance you have in mind. A good example of the problem here came when President Obama was briefed in the summer of 2016 about what the Russians were doing. And he was given all kinds of ideas of things we could do against the Russians, including cutting them off from the world financial system. But he came back to his staff and said, well, what if on election day they up the ante by going after the voting machines?
Well, that's a very good point. And that's the other question, which is retaliation, the proper balance in terms of what would deter an attack and what could lessen one that's in the offing. How do you respond to that? For example, we impose sanctions and we expelled some 35 diplomats, but really,
didn't seem to add up too much, did it, Carol?
No.
You know, in fact, there's a friend of mine who was senior in the Obama administration who's quoted in the book as saying on the day that we expelled those 35 diplomats who were actually Russian spies and we closed a couple of consular locations, including a building the Russians had where it turned out they had been digging deep underground and clamping on to a big cable underground, you know, that went right into New York City. But the fact of the matter is that when we threw out those diplomats, this government official said to me, you know, we just came up with the perfect 19th century response to a 21st century problem. And that's our difficulty. We haven't figured out how to get out ahead of it. Sanctions, we've sanctioned the North Koreans for Sony. I doubt they felt it compared to all the other sanctions we have on North Korea. So we have to begin to come up with far more creative ways where it becomes clear to a country that they will pay a high price. And to do that, you need to do two things. One is you need to improve your attribution so that it is clear that you can figure out quickly who's behind an attack. And that's much more difficult than most people think. In the movies, it happens instantly. Somebody goes to the president and say, oh, this was the Russians operating from such and such a facility. In reality, it can take months to figure that out and to go trace it back. The second thing we need to improve is our resilience, because while there is deterrence by counterattack, there's also deterrence by denial. So if you know that we've got so many backup systems that you're not likely to turn out the lights from Boston to Washington, you're probably not even going to try.
David, we have a number of questions I want to get to before we have to close. Quickly, what is the relationship, in your view, between cyber weapons and the use of social media by nation states for nefarious ends, as we saw in the 2016 election by the Russians, including Twitter bots and troll farms, as we saw with the Internet Research Agency? How do you see this nexus?
So initially, we thought of social media and the propaganda that ran on it as just an extension of the propaganda we've seen before. I mean, Stalin tried to influence American elections by putting advertisements into farm newspapers across the United States. The difference, once you turn to the kind of social media tools we've seen, Facebook, Twitter, the bots you mentioned, is that you not only have greater reach, you have greater aim. You can target certain elements of the society. And using the bots, you've got an automation effect where you can actually harass people, troll people, turn on and off their access to certain kinds of information. So it's much more than simply putting that piece of propaganda into the farm newspaper anymore. It's a sort of full-scale degree of mind control that you can attempt. Now, what's the best solution to this? The best solution is our awareness that it can happen, which in 2016 most Americans didn't have. You won't see the Russians pull the same playbooks in 2020 that they played in 2016, because we would be ready for them. The same reason a football player wouldn't go execute the same play that they know their adversaries have seen on YouTube time and time again. So we're going to have to be ready for the plays we haven't seen.
Nonetheless, these social media platforms are still fertile ground for nefarious actors.
Sure, and very hard for American intelligence to monitor, because for good legal reasons, our intelligence agencies look outside the United States. They don't look inside, which is why they didn't see the Sony hack. It's why they didn't understand what was happening on Facebook and Twitter.
What role do you see for Facebook, Twitter, Google? What role do these companies play in national security, helping to protect and thwart these attacks, because they have a hefty profit motive not to do so?
Well, they did have a hefty profit motive not to do so, but they paid such a price in the past 2 years that that motive is beginning to be recalculated some. You know, a few years ago, Facebook would have told you, we're not in the content business, we're a big pipe. Everything runs into it, we sell some advertising off of it, but we're not there to go filter the news. Then what happened? Well, they agreed, quite understandably, to a rule that says, no child pornography. That was an easy thing internationally to agree to. And then one day they got that iconic photograph of the naked girl in Vietnam running down the road fleeing napalm, right? And suddenly people said, why did you take this off of Facebook? And the answer was, it violated our rule. Well, they had to go make a decision for an exception. And that was just the beginning, the opening wedge of a whole series of judgments they're now having to make about what violates the terms of service and what doesn't. Whether something that if you or I put on Facebook would be perfectly legal would not be acceptable if it was put on by a foreign government.
We have very few minutes left, but David, I want to close by reading an excerpt from your book and ask you to respond, because I think it really does sum up the major themes. And you said that the Russian attacks exposed more than the Obama administration's lack of a playbook for cyber conflict, despite years of ever-escalating, ever-more ingenious attacks. Russia's multifaceted Gerasimov-inspired approach underscored the administration's failure to anticipate that cyber attacks can be used to undermine more than banks, databases, and electrical grids. They can be used to fray the civic threads that hold together democracy itself. And that's very important. We're seeing that throughout even this current administration.
We are. And, you know, we've seen continued attacks, some in the midterms. Just in recent days, we've seen Republican congressional committees say that they were attacked, though they didn't say by whom. And so what we know is that countries are going to use this kind of information warfare, social media attacks in the future. And the only big question is, how ready are we for it in coming years? The government is not a great group to be putting together the defenses for this. Because of the First Amendment, we want to make sure that governments stay out of our information flow. But instead, what we need to begin to do is make sure that the companies that are, in fact, the publishers and purveyors of this are our first line of defense. Not only that they will go edit this material, and we want to be careful about who's editing it, but that they will at least set up the warning that says, we think this conversation that's taking place, this political conversation, isn't just among citizens, it's among governments that are trying to influence an outcome.
The book is The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. The author, New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. David, thanks so much for coming in, and congratulations once again on your book.
Great to be with you, Carol. Great to be with you, Rick. Thanks so much.
We highly recommend obtaining and reading this excellent book. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Hannah Spagonia for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And joining me on the program was VOA science and technology broadcaster Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.